From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn, and thanks for joining us today during our fall membership drive. Today on the show, Alfonso Cuarón. For his latest movie, the Mexican filmmaker not only returned to his home country, but also returned to his childhood. Roma, which is named for the neighborhood in Mexico City where Cuarón grew up, takes place in the early 1970s when he wasn't yet a teenager. The story is largely about the people who cared for Cuarón and his siblings, their parents, whose marriage was crumbling at the time, and in particular their nanny, who goes by Cleo in the movie. Her life, in and outside of the family home, forms a large amount of the story in Roma. To shoot the film, Cuarón painstakingly recreated his childhood home. He even tracked down the family's old furniture, which relatives had dispersed across Mexico, and veracity was so important to him that he cast actors who looked like all the real people from his childhood. For the Cleo character, who is of indigenous descent, he cast a non-professional actor, a young teacher named Yalitza Aparicio. Roma unfolds slowly, almost like a dream. It's shot in black and white, and there is no musical score. Instead, what you hear are the sounds of the home, the sounds of the city, and the sounds of the world outside the family's front door. Roma had its North American premiere at the Telluride Film Festival, which is where I caught up with Cuarón. He not only wrote and directed the movie, but also was its cinematographer.
I tried the camera to be as objective as not even objective. It's almost like a ghost that is observing, looking at the past, and gliding through the past. That's the reason I wanted the camera to be very steady even when it moves, not having any shaky kind of situation. I wanted to feel more as if it's haunting you.
Memory is very tricky in terms of what we remember and what we forget and what we choose to remember and what we choose to forget. And as you're excavating your own memory, looking at furniture that you've imported to make this film, I suspect talking to your siblings, your own nanny. What was that process like about what you had misremembered or forgotten? What did that reveal about your own life that you hadn't really fully understood before?
Well, that's the thing is, when you confront your memory, you confront from the standpoint of your present, and also with all the preconceptions that we build up into who we are. And you go back and, one part of the process is not to question my memories. I believed at the beginning. But then I start talking particularly with the real life Cleo, because I didn't want it to be about, it's very clear the film is not about me. You know, I witnessed maybe 80% of the scenes that are in the film. But the film was not about me. It was about her. So that was the most important thing for me. It was that through this aspect of memory, that in my memory, she was this nurturing being, and she was this woman that was always around me. And I think that for the first time, I realized that she is a woman. You know, she's a woman with is a woman and also a woman from a different social class and from indigenous background. And I think that heightened it tainted the rest of understanding of the rest of the memories of that period.
How had you seen it differently when you hadn't seen her as her own person, as her own woman?
It was different because it's when you think, look, if you are thinking about your mom and remembering your mom, you don't really see her as a woman. You're not thinking about, say, her sexual life. You don't want to think about those things. You don't want to think too much about if she was lonely, you know, because we don't want to think that aspect of our dear ones, you know, and you just start seeing more dimensions. You know, no matter how much you try to dig into someone else, you will never have the full picture. The deeper you can go is as deep as you can go with your own relationship of affection.
But does that work the other way? That as you're thinking about other people in your life and who they were and how you misremember them or what you didn't understand about their own lives, that you start to reflect back on yourself, that the process of writing this film, making this film, starts to look at your own life in ways that maybe you had never really done, which has to be, I would imagine, potentially really difficult and painful.
Yeah, being first like couple of years just digging into your memory, confronting your memory with real life Cleo, but also with my siblings, in which I discovered, well, my younger siblings, some memories were so akin, so many others not, because he was younger, so he remembered less. He was more abstract and he was a bit confusing different periods. Or my older brother, who had decided to block more, you know. But with my sister, I found that we had a very similar recollection of events. So that was a great tool for me, you know, is with my sister to make sure that, you know, do you remember this? Yes, it was like this and that. And then so she would say something, said, oh, yeah, you're right. You know, and this is the thing of memory. You know, once that you say, oh, yes, you're right, and you get into that door, and more memories come out. But memory, like everything, is like a narrative. I always see memory as that it's like this wall that has a crack. And particularly if you go through something that is painful. You know, it's a wall with a crack. And because the crack is too painful, you create a narrative. And it's a layer of paint. And that layer of paint doesn't really fully cover the crack. So you go with another layer of different color. And the crack is still be seen. So you keep on doing layer after layer after layer after layer of things in which the crack is still there. You are unaware of it. I mean, you don't see it, but it's there. And to try to go and see that crack again, you have to peel layer of narrative. You know, it's narratives that we create to ourselves. So it's very complicated. You know, it's by the way, I would never claim that what is in the film is the truth. Because probably the truth is hidden under many other layers of paint.
Maybe it's not factual, but maybe it's truthful.
Well, that is, yes, I agree with you. I agree with you, yeah.
Coming up, more with filmmaker Alfonso Cuarón, and we remember screenwriter William Goldman.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting LA's Uncabaret, celebrating 25 years with this one-time-only evening of live comedy, music, and never-before-seen footage from the vault. Featuring Beth Lapidus, Patton Oswalt, Julia Sweeney, Janine Garofalo, Bob Odenkirk, Greg Barron, and Jill Soloway. Also featuring Maria Bamford, Julie Goldman, Byron Bowers, and surprise guests. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, my guest is filmmaker Alfonso Cuarón. His new movie, Roma, is his most personal film, and in some ways, it might be one of the most personal movies I've seen a prominent filmmaker make in a very long time. Roma is a story of Cuarón's childhood, and yet the young Alfonso is not the main character, and the camera isn't even shooting from his point of view. Instead, the focus is on Cuarón's parents, namely his mother and his nanny, Libo, who is renamed in the film Cleo. Roma takes place in the early 1970s, when student uprisings in Mexico City were brutally squashed by a paramilitary group of the government. It was also a significant time for the adults in Alfonso Cuarón's life. His parents' marriage was crumbling, and his nanny had her own troubled story outside of the family. Now we'll pick up my conversation with Cuarón, talking about how he balanced the practical aspects of running a massive film shoot with the emotional reality of recreating his childhood for the big screen.
It took a while because, you know, the after going through all of this thing of memories and all this research, to call it like that, it was just the pragmatic element of filmmaking. Okay, we need to get the furniture, we need to get the location, we need to get the perfect tiles, and you're just going to fixate in details, you know? Those are not the tiles, we need to, the tiles were like this or like that. Okay, yes, like that, you know? And in a very pragmatic mode and casting, you know, because the actors, they have to be just identical or looking as similar as possible to the original people. And the costumes, they have to be the same. Then you start shooting. And like the first few days of shooting any film, you're learning your crew, learning dynamics in the set of everyone, and more important, cementing your language. The language that you follow is going to be consistent. But I found myself so many times being in a very, very lousy mood. You know, and yes, because of the size of the film, and it's, you know, I think that a film that it was way bigger than probably any other Mexican production, you know, I found myself sometimes upset. And one day I found myself in this particularly lousy mood. And I'm shooting this scene, and I'm so frustrated that I have to just say, okay, let's take 5 minutes. I need to take a walk. And I took a walk, and it was the street where I grew up. And I'm walking, and I says, wow, man, you're so upset. And you're upset, and the crew actually is doing a good job today. They're really doing a great job, and look around. You know, you're shooting in your childhood street, and I said, wow, what's going on? Why are you so upset? Relax, you know, it's like, how many people have the chance to recreate their childhood? And there's a reason why you don't do it, okay? I go back to keep on working, and I tell the actor, have you ever felt suffocated? I says, yes. And we start talking about feeling suffocated in life. I said, what happened in this scene is simple. You feel suffocated. You cannot breathe. And you're not going to have the sense of not being able to breathe until you get into the car and begin breathing. But when the car starts and you drive away, oh man, if it's a relief, you really breathe again. We do the scene. It's great. And it's when I realize that I'm directing the character of my father leaving the family. You know, I'm a person that I always judge from outside. And for the first time, I have to dig into his motivation. I mean, the man, I'm not going to justify if he was selfish or not selfish. But he was feeling suffocated, you know, and he could not stand there in that family anymore.
Let me ask this last question. People who see this film, and I'm including myself, re-examine the way that we look at our families, our spouses, and in my case, our nanny, who's been with us for a very long time, since our son, who is 18 now, was 3 months old. Do you do the same? Do you look at this movie and re-examine your relationships to your family, to your kids, and the woman who helped raise you?
It was impossible after 1 year of living in that house of my childhood, just hanging out with my own family 50 years ago, recreating those scenes, recreating also a common wound. You know, it's, you know, coming out of that. And as everything is serendipity, you know, as everything is kind of in sync because, you know, like it was December that I felt that my mom, you know, her days were ending. So I decided to see a cut of the film, and then a couple of months later she passed. So happy that she saw it. But then, yeah, that creates this great bond. But by the same token, by digging out into the scars, also you open other wounds. You know, you open other wounds and that you have to heal. But that's part of what love is about. It's about healing wounds.
Alfonso, so great to see you.
Hey, Sean, thank you so much for this conversation.
Alfonso Cuarón's Roma will open in a limited number of theaters on November 21st. Then it will be on Netflix starting December 14th. And now we can't say goodbye without acknowledging the passing of one of the great American screenwriters. William Goldman wrote All the President's Men, Misery, and The Princess Bride. He adapted his own novel, Marathon Man, for the screen. And his memoir, Adventures in the Screen Trade, is one of the best books about Hollywood. But his greatest screenplay was undoubtedly Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. In this scene, the outlaws Butch and Sundance, played by Robert Redford and Paul Newman, are trapped by a posse on the edge of a cliff.
No, we'll jump.
Like hell we will.
No, it'll be okay. If the water's deep enough, we don't get squished to death. They'll never follow us.
How do you know?
Would you make a jump like that you didn't have to?
I have to, and I'm not gonna.
Well, we got to, otherwise we're dead. They're just gonna have to go back down the same way they come. Come on.
Just one clear shot, that's all I want.
Come on. We got to.
Nope. Get away from me.
Why?
I want to fight them.
They'll kill us.
Maybe.
You want to die?
Do you?
All right. I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
Why, are you crazy? The fall will probably kill you.
William Goldman died last night at the age of 87. And that is The Frame for this week. Our show is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett. Our intern is Maria Alexa Cavanaugh. Our engineer is Valentino Rivera. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening and for supporting all the programming on KPCC during this membership drive. We really appreciate it. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday.